Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings, friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live on radio stations from California to Pennsylvania, streaming down from outer space on the Sirius satellite radio system. Beaming around the planet on RadioPower.org, WhiteRoseSociety.org, AirAmericaRadio.com, and also on cable systems in 29 states on CRN Digital. Welcome to our program. Here we are, Thursday, creeping up on the new year, the end of the year. An appropriate time to look back on the high and low points of the year, but not with the typical, the top 10, the worst 10, all that kind of thing. Let's look at the criminals of the last year. The real criminals of the last year. Russell Mokyber is with us. He's the editor of Corporate Crime Reporter, corporatecrimereporter.com, the website. Hey, Russell, welcome to the program.
Good morning.
And tell us, you have a brand new report up.
Crime Without Conviction.
And the subtitle is The Rise of Deferred and Non-Prosecution Agreements. What the heck is a deferred and non-prosecution agreement?
Well, I didn't know either. I went to a press conference at the Justice Department in August, and the Attorney General of the United States, Alberto Gonzalez, was first thing he said, well, KPMG today, KPMG is one of the four largest accounting firms in the world, admitted to criminal wrongdoing in the largest ever tax shelter fraud, cost the government $2.5 billion.
Now, hang on just a second here. Just to make this real for people, I mean, this is the equivalent of you or me holding a press conference with the prosecutor of our respective town or state and saying, yes, I confess I just embezzled $1 million from my employer, or yes, I confess I just, I'm the guy who stuck the hacked card into the ATM machine and got it to spit out $10,000, and I took it and I spent it all and it's all gone. Right. Sort
yeah,
that kind
and,
of thing.
And then the prosecutor gets up and said, "This person is guilty of a crime. This
right.
person admits it's criminal wrongdoing."
Right. Okay. So,
and I'm
so
waiting
now,
there.
Now,
I'm waiting there. There are all these reporters, and there's
right.
all this, and the prosecutors are saying how bad all this was. And I says, "Well, where's the plea agreement? How come this major player, this powerful institution, this accountant to Fortune 500 companies?" How come they're not pleading guilty if the Attorney General of the United States says they're admitting to criminal wrongdoing in the largest tax shelter fraud case ever that cost the government $2.5 billion? How come? Because they got a special deal. And the special deal is called the Deferred Prosecution Agreement, which was this device was originally intended for juvenile delinquents. It was to clear the courts of minor cases so that the criminal justice system could focus on major criminal cases like corporate crime cases. And so, for example, if I engaged in some petty theft and it was my first offense, the prosecutor said, I'm going to charge you with petty theft. But if you stay clean for 2 years, I'll drop the charges and there won't be a record. I'm not going to destroy you over your first offense, over this minor crime. That's how we clear the courts from these minor kinds of crimes. But what we found in this report is that increasingly over the last couple of years, it's the settlement option of choice for prosecutors and defense attorneys in major corporate crime cases.
Now, let me just get this straight. I have a confession to make, Russell. We're talking with Russell Mokyber. He's the editor of CorporateCrimeReporter.com.
Which, by the way, is you say .com, that's where the report is, and you can see all these deals, or 27 of the 34 of these deals. We've found them, and we've linked them on our site. Plus, Corporate Crime Reporter is a weekly print newsletter, and it goes primarily to prosecutors, defense attorneys. The way I educated myself about this was actually interviewing. We do a 45-minute interview question-answer format, interviewing every week the prosecutors and the defense lawyers. And they're saying, best thing since sliced bread.
Now, when I was 10 years old,
friend of mine, a kid by the name of Alvin, lived in our neighborhood, and the big rage at that time, this was when I was 10, that was 36 years ago, or 34 years ago, or 44 years ago, I guess, yeah. The big rage was these little things that were stuck on the outside of cereal boxes where you look at it from one angle, and it's one picture of a cartoon character, and you look at it from another angle, and it's another picture. You know, this is like pre-hologram. Yeah, almost 3D. Yeah, those kind of things. And Alvin said, let's go into the A&P and steal a couple of these things. And I was like, no way. And he was like, no, we got to do this. So we went into the A&P, and we stole a couple of them off the cereal boxes. And I got to tell you, to this day, I feel guilty about it. I mean, you know,
Is this the first time you've admitted it publicly?
Honest to God, it really and truly is. And for months after that, I felt terrible about it. I finally told my father about it, probably 5 years later. And I didn't, you know, and I stopped hanging out with Alvin. But I could have gotten busted for that. The manager of the AAP could have arrested me. And, you know, I was a juvenile. And so there was a law that was passed, this deferred prosecution agreement, so that if, you know, a 10-year-old kid gets dragged in for stealing something from the store, or
right,
even a larger
crime. His life. It doesn't
right.
destroy his life. So there's not a conviction on his record.
That's right.
And
this law...
Like there's like a probationary period, and sometimes there's conditions of the probation, but after 2 years, the slate's wiped clean. So,
right. So by the time I'm 12, nobody knows about it, and I don't have to serve time in juvenile detention. I might have to not go into A&P stores for a while or something like that. And this law is now being used to protect corporate criminals who rip us off to the tune of billions.
Well, that's what we found, and I'm not saying that there's no case where the prosecutor shouldn't use these for corporate crime cases. Like in a close case, and these are very difficult cases to prove. So in a close case, if you can get the cooperation of the corporate defense attorney and the corporation, and so this information becomes public, and there's a bad day for the corporation, and there's not a conviction. Okay, in a close case. But where the Attorney General of the United States stands up and says there was obstruction in this case, there was a massive fraud in this case, we're going to charge the company with a felony in this case, but if it does everything we say after 2 years, the slate's going to be wiped clean. I think that's inappropriate.
Inappropriate? I think that's a crime itself.
I think it's inappropriate, and it's just not just one case. It's just like we found 34 of them. So we're raising the flag. We're saying this trend has gone too far, and in the last four years, there have been 23 of them, which is twice as many in the previous 10 years. So it's starting to accelerate in the defense attorneys, the defense bars, again, I interview them almost every week, these lawyers, they're saying it's the best thing since sliced bread. One guy said to me, is there a double standard between individuals and corporations? Absolutely. Should there be? Absolutely. And when you talk to them about it, what they say is, a corporation is a legal fiction. You can't put a corporation in jail. So cooperate. The corporation should cooperate with the prosecutors and throw the guilty executives in jail, which I agree with. I think Ken Lay, if the government proves its case, should go to jail for a long time.
Yeah, let me toss in here, though, that a corporation cannot go to jail, but a corporation can have a death sentence executed against it. It can be dissolved.
Absolutely, and it can be put on probation, and the judge can tell it what to do and that kind of stuff. So there are all kinds of things that you can do, number one. Number two, the argument I would make is, okay, and they say, you know, only a living... One professor at George Mason University, right-winger Jeffrey Parker, says a corporation cannot commit a crime. A corporation has no mind. The only thing can commit a crime is a human being because it has a mind.
Well, wait a second. Russell McIver, if that's the case with CorporateCrimeReporter.com, if that's the case, then why is it that Nike asserted before the Supreme Court last year that it had the First Amendment right to lie to people because free speech is guaranteed to all persons and as a corporation is a person? Why is it that Dow Chemical asserted that they had the Fourth Amendment right of privacy to keep the EPA from doing surprise inspections? Successfully argued that before the Supreme Court.
Well,
why is it that the big chain stores, JCPenney, 1936 versus Florida, this Supreme Court case, argued, and this is what Walmart now uses to bulldoze into communities, said you can't keep us out of your community because that's the same as discriminating against a black person in a restaurant. I mean, you've got corporations who are claiming these rights.
Right, and what I would say is, okay, I would make this deal with corporate America. If you feel that you should get rid of corporate criminal liability because you're not a human being, then we will strip you of your rights of that were originally granted to human beings under the Constitution.
Yeah, because they weren't given these rights at the founding of this country. They have slowly acquired them, by and large, by subterfuge.
Well, and throwaway lines by the Supreme Court. So,
by the court reporter, John Chandler Bancroft Davis,
right,
in 1886.
So let's cut a deal. And I've actually said to I interviewed David Petofsky, who cut one of these deals for computer. Well, he was a prosecutor of the Computer Associates case, and now he's a defense attorney. I said, would any corporate attorney agree to the following deal? Okay, we don't criminally prosecute the company, and the company gives up its rights under the Constitution. Answer: no, not a good deal.
Yeah. Exactly. I mean, they want to have
it. Level the playing field.
They want to have the whole thing, and it's just absolutely wrong. You can learn all about it by going to corporatecrimereporter.com. The actual report is right there. Russell Mulciber. Russell, thank you so much for being with us and for the great work you're doing out there.
Thank you, Tom.
Great talking with you today. Amazing. Absolutely amazing. 16 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman. We'll be right back.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Drastic time for sure. We need an antidote and a cure.
There you go. Muhammad got a problem with your whole. How about some peace? It's just beginning. 22 minutes past the hour. Welcome back, my friends. Well, let's see. What is a person? A corporation can't get arrested. As we just learned from Russell Mulciber over at corporatecrimereporter.com. But this. From the Irish Independent News, police in Lagos, Nigeria, arrested a cow. They killed a bus driver who was urinating on a road in the city's Ojo district in June. The cow also injured several bystanders. In August, another cow was thrown in Girón Prison, Colombia, for jaywalking after colliding with a motorist, even though the rider was not seriously hurt, said a police spokesman. If it were a person who caused the accident, he or she would be behind bars, so why not the cow? Which raises the question, if you or I stole over $1 billion and we were put in jail, then why not a corporation that does the same? Let's see. Cows that jaywalk go to jail. Cows that pee on the side of the road illegally go to jail. People who jaywalk or who pee on the side of the road illegally or who embezzle billions of dollars go to jail. Corporations? Nope. They get a pass. They get a pass. Something stinks. By the way, welcome back to our program. Tom Hartman here with you. Our telephone number, 1-866-440-8466, 866-440-THOM. The website is TomHartman.com. If you'd like to drop into our live chat room, just click live chat. However you spell Tom Hartman, we'll get you there, although it's T-H-O-M Hartman with two N's. Welcome back to our program. The result of the insane international trade policies, the bankruptcies, the essential, profound, and horrific bankruptcy of I mean that metaphorically and literally, of the U.S. trade policies, both under Bush, it started with Reagan, this whole thing of this free, the idea of free trade, and then George Bush Sr. saying, you know, he wanted to have fast-track authority and the ability to negotiate these kind of treaties without congressional approval and all this kind of thing. And then Clinton coming along and saying, oh, well, let's just kick the doors open. And somebody just emailed me yesterday Mickey Cantor, Clinton's trade guy, his trade representative, U.S. trade representative, on the board of Monsanto. Gee, why am I not surprised? Clinton kicking the door wide open by saying, yeah, sure, you know, we'll sign the, you know, these trade agreements. It's, we'll sign the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trades, NAFTA, GATT, no problem. Everything's fine. An enormous amount of wealth is being sold to foreign companies, to people and corporations in foreign countries from within the United States. Why? Because they are sitting on our money and they have to do something with it. And it's our money, so they have to spend it back here. See, here's the problem. This year, we're going to buy hundreds of billions of dollars worth of stuff from, for example, China. Now, you know, we're buying it from other countries all over the place, but we're buying a lot of oil from Venezuela, for example. We're buying a lot of stuff from Germany. We're buying a lot of stuff from China. But just to take China as an example, and they have to figure out, what are we going to do with all these dollars? These people, you know, the Americans bought all this stuff, and they gave us dollars for it. And you know, so we've got to buy something. The problem is that America, we've got to buy something that is denominated in dollars. Currently, there's oil. But the problem is that, you know, America's really not making anything that China wants to buy anymore. I mean, pretty much anything that we were making that they wanted to buy, they bought up the company. And they shipped it over there. We're not making our own Abrams tanks anymore. I mean, we can't fight a war anymore. We're not manufacturing this stuff domestically. So what's going to completely blow your mind is how is what is happening with these American dollars that are going overseas, not just the, you know, when you're riding alone, you're riding with Osama, not just your oil dollars, not just the petrodollars, not just the money we spend when we buy gasoline, and that money ends up with, everybody knows, you know, Saudi Arabia, and they make all this money, and Saudi Arabia is running an incredible surplus right now, and, you know, more madrasas and more terror, you know, or more radicals, let's say, more Islamic radicals out there, and all that. Not that, but the actual selling off of the United States, piece by piece, that has been supervised and overseen by basically the last four administrations. And this is the exact reversal of what had been going on for the first 200 years in this country. It used to be American companies, if they were engaged in an international trade in the context of buying other companies, were buying companies in other countries or setting up subsidiaries in other countries. Now it has reversed. I'll tell you all about that right after this. 27 minutes past the hour.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
Shake it up. Shake it up. Shake it up.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you, 34 minutes past the hour. I was promising to share with you this. This is mind-boggling. Just looking at the time period. Just simply at the time period from 1995 to 2005, from basically the beginning of the Clinton embrace of free trade, the DLC love affair with free trade, so-called free trade. There's nothing free about it. And today. And you think, you know, American companies, right? Now, I was using the example of China. They get all these U.S. dollars. What are they going to do? Well, they're going to buy oil with a lot of them. Where are they going to buy that oil from? A lot of them, they're going to buy it from the United Kingdom. British Petroleum, huge oil company, major supplier of oil to China. They're going to buy a lot of it from Saudi Arabia. They're going to buy a lot of it from Venezuela. They're going to buy a lot of it from Canada. A lot of people don't realize that Venezuela and Canada are two of our largest oil suppliers. And then, of course, you know, you Germany and Luxembourg and Italy and other countries like that that they are engaged in some trade with. They have to be. So here are what these dollars are being used for. the dollars that we are sending overseas so that we can have cheap junk in Walmarts and other stores, so that we can no longer have jobs here, but we can have cheap stuff. Remember the con saying, oh, you know, you wouldn't want to have tariffs that might protect domestic industries and keep the shoe manufacturers and the T-shirt manufacturers and the clothing manufacturers and the computer manufacturers and the TV manufacturers and the radio manufacturers and the light bulb manufacturers and pretty much, you know, fill-in-the-blank manufacturers here in the United States. You wouldn't want to have that because then the price would go up. And the simple answer is, well, yeah, but so would my wages, because then I'd have a good manufacturing job. So, yes, I would, frankly, like to undo the last, you know, 30 years here, particularly the last 10 years. And it is possible, by the way. We can simply walk away from these agreements. It just takes political will. But here's what happened. Here's what happened. We bought all this stuff overseas. We handed them all these dollars, many of them, by the way, borrowed. In fact, huge, huge quantities of them borrowed. And we sent all these dollars overseas, and now those dollars are coming back. And what are they doing? They're buying our infrastructure. America is for sale at fire sale prices. British Petroleum has bought Amoco. We no longer own Amoco. The United Kingdom owns it. $48 billion. BP bought ARCO. We no longer own ARCO. Again, the United Kingdom. Texaco is gone. This was bought by the Netherlands. Pennzoil, the original, this is where the oil industry started. Quaker State Company, Pennsylvania Oil Company, Pennzoil, bought by Shell Oil of the Netherlands. Texaco refining operations, bought by Saudi Arabia. Amerant Hess, bought by Venezuela. Chevron, bought by Canada. Monsanto Oil Company, bought by Australian company, BHP Petroleum of America. Citgo, bought by Property and BV of the Netherlands. That's just the oil industry. Look at telecommunications. I'm just going to go through some of the largest ones here. Telecommunications. AirTouch Communications, now owned by folks in the United Kingdom, cost $60 billion. They came to the United States. VoiceStream Wireless Corp. is now owned by a company in Germany. $29 billion. AT&T Worldwide Assets and Operations, bought by British Worldwide Telecom Worldwide, $5 billion from the UK. GE Americom Telecommunications, SES Global SA in Luxembourg bought them for $4 billion. The list goes on, down a total of $146 billion in that industry. Transportation, total in transportation, $54 billion. Germany, Daimler-Benz bought Chrysler. France bought AT&T Industrial Automotive Electrical, France's Vallejo SA company. Allied Signal, an auto braking company, is now owned by Bosch of Germany. Bluebird Corp. is now owned by Hensley's Group in the United Kingdom. Motor Coach Industries is now owned by Consorcio de Grupo Danalas in Mexico. Dana Corp., driveline business, is now owned by Driveline Assembly, the United Kingdom, GKN. Mack Trucks, you think Mack Trucks are all American? They were bought by a company in France, Renault Vehicles Industries, for $104 million. Delphi, bought by China. General Motors Assembly Line, bought by China General Engine Factory. Dana Corp., this is $17 million. Dana Corp., Kirstall Forging Company, bought by Bhopal Forge in Bharat, India. Printing and Publishing Services, Harcourt General. Harcourt Brace, you know, big publisher in the United States. Now they're owned by the U.K., $5 billion acquisition. Simon & Schuster, you thought that was an American company? Not anymore. The U.K. owned them. West Publishing Company, you thought they were in America? No, sorry, Canada owns them. Macmillan Publishing Company, now they're owned by Maxwell in the United Kingdom. Houghton Mifflin, you thought Houghton, you know, you'd buy into American books, right? No, sorry, they're owned by Vivendi in France, $2 billion. Ziff Davis, $2 billion acquisition by SoftBank in Japan. CBS Record Groups, sorry, that's now owned in Japan by a company in Japan. Random House, my publisher, the publisher that publishes several of my books. They are now owned by Bertelsmann in Germany, the largest publishing company in the world, by the way. They also bought Doubleday Publishing. Harper & Row has been bought out by an Australian company, Rupert Murdoch's News America Holdings, Inc. And Addison Wesley Publishing Company, for those of you who are, you know, the techno geeks, they're now owned by Pearson in the United Kingdom. $56.371 billion to buy our publishing businesses. In mining, Magna Copper, just a lot of these companies you won't be so familiar with. Insurance, John Hancock, the guy who put his signature on the Declaration of Independence. They named an insurance company after him. John Hancock is now owned by the Canadians. Farmers Group is now owned by the United Kingdom. Transamerica Group, owned in the Netherlands. Cigna Corp is owned in Bermuda. American Bankers Group, owned in Belgium. Providian Corp Insurance, owned in the Netherlands. $85 billion worth of acquisitions in insurance. You look at the electronics and electrical industry. $61 billion total acquisition here. AMP Corp, D3 Group, Silicon Valley Group, Chipback, VLSI Technology. Now also sold to companies overseas. GTE Electrical Products of Sylvania, now owned in Germany. On and on. Westinghouse Electric Power Equipment, Zenith Electronics. Drugs. Consider the pharmaceuticals. Smith, Klein, Beckman. It's now owned by Beecham Group in the United Kingdom. Marion Merrill Dow, Inc., now owned by Hirsch in Germany. Syntex, now owned by Roche Holding in Switzerland. Rohr Corporation, now owned in France. Gentech, Switzerland bought them. They're a company in Switzerland. Chiron Diagnostics in Germany. Computer and office equipment. IBM Corp's hard disk drives. Hitachi bought them for $2 billion. Kingston Technology, they were bought by a Japanese company. SoftBank. Amdahl Group, bought by a Japanese company. Maxtor Corp, bought by a South Korean corporation. And on that list goes Machinery, U.S. Filter Corporation, Westinghouse Convan Power Generation, Rexnord, and that list, Ingersoll Rand Drilling Business. It's owned by the Swedes now. Metal and Metal Products, Triangle Industries, $3.6 billion bought by the French. Lucent Technology Optical Fiber Unit, bought by the Japanese, $2.1 billion. Inland Steel Corporation, now owned by the Dutch, $1.4 billion. Allied Signal, now owned by the Germans, $815 million. And Bankers Trust of New York is now owned by a German bank, $9 billion. Republic Bank of New York is owned by the United Kingdom, $7 billion. Bank North Group is now owned by Canada, Centura Bank, Canada. Mellon Financial. Mellon! The guy who was... I'm reaching the edge here. $2.1 billion bought about by a bank, a Citizens Financial Group in the United Kingdom. Motion Pictures. MCA goes to Japan, $7 billion. Columbia Pictures of Entertainment goes to Japan, $4 billion. MGM goes to Luxembourg, $1.7 million. All American Communications goes to the United Kingdom, $500 million. RCA Columbia Home Video goes to Japan, $350 million. And I've only read you half the list. This is the selling out of America. What this list is the list of companies that have been bought out in the United States because we have been buying so much junk from overseas and we have been importing so much oil. We've been so dependent on other companies. We have been tossing them so much money because of our insane trade policies, absolutely nuts, over the edge, over the top, out of control, running us into the bankruptcy trade policies. That all these countries are sitting on all this money, and what are they going to do with that money? They are buying our businesses. Now, you'd say, oh, isn't that great? It's called insourcing. Now I go to work for Toyota. Now I go to work for Sony. Now I go to work for a company in Germany. I'm still getting a paycheck. Yeah, but where's the profit going? I mean, the whole reason for running a business is to generate a profit, right? The profit's not staying in the United States anymore. This is incredible. John in New Albany, Indiana. John, you got some comments on this? We got about a minute.
I was just telling the screener there that I had attended a conference. I'm in the recycling business. And one of the presenters at this conference was telling us that the United States is the number one exporter of a product in the world, number one exporter in the whole world of this one product, and that product is trash.
Right.
We export more recyclable cardboard and plastic bottles and whatnot to China, and then they turn around and send that back to us with...
as toys and finished goods,
yes,
and computer parts.
As toys and as boxes to put the toys in and whatnot.
That's the definition of a third world country, John.
Exactly. That's what I was telling him. That's what the guy said. He said, you know, basically we've fallen into that category where we are the... We export raw materials and import manufactured
finished goods. That's right. When Ronald Reagan came to office, we were the largest exporter in the world of finished goods, of finished manufactured materials. John, thanks a lot for the call. And now we are the largest importer in the world of finished goods. When Ronald Reagan came into office, we were the largest We were the largest, importer of raw materials, yeah, and exporter of finished goods. Now it's exactly reverse. We are now the largest importer of finished goods and the largest exporter of raw materials. We have become a third world nation.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Back with friends. It's 9 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Yeah, no flag should ever be more highly revered than the Constitution for which it stands, or the nation, or the ideals, or the principles. This whole idea of let's have an amendment to ban burning of the flag. I'd rather have an amendment to ban shredding of the Constitution. 1-866-440-8466. Our telephone number, Luke in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Hey, Luke, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom, how you doing?
I'm great, but I'll get better. What's up, Luke?
I'm doing pretty well. I keep listening once in a while. And I'm having an issue with the comments about the cow
right.
being arrested. I mean, I think that's pretty ludicrous. I mean, do you agree? Or?
Well, actually, you know, there's sort of a story behind the story, which wasn't in the news story that I read you, but just from personal experience, I've been in that part of the world. And if you own a cow in that part of the world, that is not only a major source of wealth for you, but it's also a major source of income for you. And if that cow is allowed to misbehave, in other words, if you're not taking care of your cow, but it's wandering in traffic or something, the impounding of the cow, the arresting of the cow, taking away the cow, is a way of punishing you for letting that happen, for creating a public nuisance.
Now, I agree that you should... That the corporation should be held as accountable as much as individuals are. Now, I'm more conservative than you'll ever be, but I agree with you on that point. But what happens when you disintegrate the company? What happens to the little guys that work for that company?
Oh, this has happened thousands of times in America. In fact, literally hundreds of times a year leading up to the Civil War, corporations got the death sentence. And what happens, in fact, up until 1860, corporations could not exist for more than 40 years in most states. In some states, it was 30 years, and there were a couple states, it was only 20 years. What happens at the end of that time? Well, let me just explain. What happens at the end of that time is the corporation dissolves its assets, and, you know, distributes the wealth to the stockholders, and new stockholders can start a new corporation. In other words, they can sort of restart, but it has to essentially go through the equivalent of probate. The whole idea of the founders, and the reason why this was the case in every state in the United States from the founding of this country in the 1770s right up through the end of the Civil War, was because nobody wanted there ever to be a landed gentry in the United States. We had fought against a hereditary aristocracy, the British, you know, the idea of kings and kingdoms. And they didn't want there to be a vehicle by which a landed gentry, an aristocracy, could arise, where you would end up with a dozen or two dozen or three dozen or 50 or 100 even super wealthy families who essentially ended up controlling everything by virtue of the power of their wealth. And the two ways that they did this was, number one, the inheritance tax, and number two, saying that a corporation, which is a means by which a small number of people can accumulate wealth, could not live longer than the productive lifespan of a human being. That changed after the Civil War, and that's when we saw the rise of the robber barons, and since then we've seen the rise of the new modern American aristocracy. You know, none of the founders left dynasties. That was intentional. They designed America not to be dynastic.
Well, we want to be a leading nation, though. I mean, is it bad to be a leading nation? I just think it may be better.
But see, this is why Mexico is in such trouble, is because there's 36 families that basically own the country. It's an oligarchy. This is what's happened in three quarters of the South American countries, and that's the direction the United States has been going in slowly since the Gilded Age. I mean, rather rapidly actually during the early years of the Gilded Age. Slowly throughout the Golden Age of the American middle class, when we jacked the maximum income tax rate up to 90% on anything over the equivalent of $4 million a year in today's income. And now, suddenly, ever since Reagan, again, we're heading in that direction very rapidly, back toward the aristocracy, the kingdoms of Europe, that we fought against. So,
yeah.
That, yep.
I kind of disagree with that, because I would think that it would be better for us to, if we found that there were intentional cause for us to, you know, to swindle $2.5 billion, or if that was the correct number, then why don't we, if we find that and it is guilty, the company is guilty of that, why don't we just sell the company to another company so that they can correct that, and the workers can actually keep a lifestyle that they wanted to keep anyway?
Well, the reality is that if you dissolve a company, if you give a company a death sentence and you dissolve the company, if there is any demand at all out there in the marketplace for their products, somebody will fill that demand and they will hire those workers. It's just that simple. Luke, thanks a lot for the call. It's great to hear from you. Lee in Fort Jackson, South Carolina. Hey, Lee, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. I had some comments on the free trade issue. I think the issue has two prongs we need to look at. It is the economic prong and the strategic prong. I think economically, there's not a lot inherently wrong with shifting to a knowledge-based economy. I think that's the future of wealth, and I think we've seen that.
Why should we shift to it? Why can't we simply acquire it? Why do we have to give up manufacturing in order to have intellectual-based economies?
Well, if that's where the free market is taking us...
No, it is not a free market, Lee. I'm sorry. The number of... if you print out the regulations that constitute the agreements that created the WTO, it would fill a room that's 20 feet by 20 feet by 8 feet tall. There's nothing free about it. It's highly regulated. It's just regulated to the benefit of corporations and against sovereign nations.
Okay, and that gets into the strategic prong. I think that strategically we can, you know, examine, you know, and we should examine the strategic implications of, you know, selling out our corporations and our infrastructure.
I agree. I absolutely agree. I mean, we can't make an Abrams tank now. We can't make a Trident missile. We can't make a battleship now without parts from China, who 6 months ago threatened to nuke 100 of our cities.
Right.
I mean, this is, I know, I realize I'm starting to sound like Barry Goldwater, but holy cow, I mean, you know, what has happened to defending America? Lee, thanks for the call. I appreciate it. Great to hear from you. I mean, This is not a conservative or liberal issue. This is not a Democratic or Republican issue. This is, are we standing up for America, or are we standing up for the multinational corporations? And tragically, so many of our politicians of both parties, frankly, largely of the Republican ilk, but also there are Democrats in there, have decided that they're standing for the multinational corporations and not for America and not for Americans. And I'm sorry, that's where I draw the line. I'm standing here for America and Americans. Period. You want to call that liberal? Go ahead. I don't care. That's what it's all about for me. It's 57 minutes past the hour.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends, to the radio support group of, by, and for we, the people of the United States, the Tom Hartman Radio Program. 6 minutes past the hour in the second hour of our program. Economyandcrisis.org, by the way, the website where I got the statistics I was sharing with you in the previous hour. A number of people in the chat room having asked, you know, where'd you get this information? If you want to drop into the our live chat room, by the way, go to tomhartman.com and simply click the link for live chat, and poof, it'll take you there. If you have any problem loading it in the first place, you may want to go to java.com and get the latest version of Java, because it's a Java applet. And if you have pop-up protection on your computer, when you first log in or when you first register for it, you know, just give it your username and password, and that's all that you have to do. You may have to hold down the control key when you click the register button, because it will pop up a little thing where you pop in that information. So just as an FYI, how to use the live chat room for those folks who are not familiar with it, because it's really a hoot hanging out there, and there's some really, really fine people there. Our telephone number, 866-440-8466, 866-440-THOM, toll-free across the United States. And I want to carry on this theme of the Bush administration and these so-called conservatives selling the United States down the tubes, not just economically, but now legally. Here we have a whole variety of actual bad guys out there. At least, you know, if if the trials are to be believed, then I think that they are, by and large, people who actually were out to get the United States. You know, people who were trying to harm us, who were tried and who were prosecuted in the United States, who are now saying, "Hey, wait a minute, we want you to set aside our conviction because you guys obtained the information illegally." I mean, this is the kind of stuff that bumbling screw up cops and prosecutors, and the vast majority of cops and prosecutors are not bumbling screw-ups, by the way. But the bumbling screw-up ones, when they do this kind of stuff, you know, rightfully their communities hold them to account and say, "Hey, wait a minute." And now Bush has done this, you know, by corrupting the NSA and the NSA process. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. Tony in Chicago, Illinois. Hey, Tony, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
I am great, but I'll get better. What's up, Tony?
Hey, Tom. I'm reading a book right now called The Long Emergency.
Yeah, I'm familiar with it.
have you read the book?
I have not read it word for word, but I have it, and I've read pieces of it, yeah.
Well, there's a question in there. His basic premise is that you're familiar with the concept of peak oil, of course.
I wrote a book about it. It's called The Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight, Ancient Sunlight being oil.
Yes. And he follows up pretty much on that same idea. But he's saying basically that what we're looking at in our society right now is there's no way that we're going to be able to overcome the technological and energy concerns that we're looking at.
Yeah.
Do you agree with that? I mean,
no,
he also says that hydrogen fuel is more or less a pipe dream simply because of the chemical problems associated with hydrogen. Do you agree with that or no?
No, I disagree with him. I strongly disagree with him, in fact, in that regard, to the extent that you're characterizing what he's saying. I mean, in The Long Emergency, there are some really, you know, he makes some very good points. And we do have to reconfigure our economy in many ways. We have to reconfigure how we conduct ourselves, how we live in the United States in many ways. But the simple situation is that, you know, we don't have to fall off the edge of a cliff. In fact, if we were to go back to the things that Jimmy Carter was trying to get us to do back in the late 1970s, and face the fact that there really is an energy crisis, there really is a problem, and that something can be done about it, then, you know, I think that it could be a boom that would make the dot-com boom look like a picnic. It would look like nothing. The opportunity is extraordinary. I think it's one of the reasons why, when I was in Germany a couple weekends ago, you drive across Germany, they just put, and Tony, thanks for the call. I gotta pop you off here, but, the German government has come up with this program where they are now offering, they're saying, if you put solar panels on the roof of your house, the electric company is required by law to buy the electricity back from you that is generated by those solar panels at 8 times the going price. Why? Because when the electric industry builds a plant, during the first 10 years after that plant is constructed, there's about an eight-time cost to recover the cost of, you know, the electricity is really 8 times more expensive than it's being sold for the first 8 years. So basically the power companies are having to buy this back at 8 times. Plus the government is not requiring, the banks are offering loans to put these things up, 10-year, basically like mortgage loans, tax deductible on the interest, and the government is subsidizing the loans so that the loans are around 2% interest, if I remember correctly. And I saw one of these things. I walked in Stadtsteinach, great big unit on the roof of a house, and Samuel took me downstairs and showed me all the, you know, really cool equipment, and they're generating, you know, like 8 kilowatts of power there, you know, you see hundreds of amps of electricity and volts and whatnot. And what happens is you're selling back the electricity to the power company. The profit that you're making on that is enough to make the payments, the monthly payments for those 10 years on the solar cells. The average lifespan of the solar cells is 50 years. So at the end of 10 years, you've broken even on those first 10 years. At the end of 10 years, you are now making a profit. And the country no longer needs to rely. They don't need to build any more nuclear plants. They don't need to build any more coal plants. They don't need to build any more oil plants. They're getting off their addiction. Germany doesn't have oil resources. And they're getting off their addiction to oil. In fact, you drive into a gas station and they've got benzene, gasoline, diesel, and biodiesel, you know, recycled French fry oil. It's right there. And it's actually the cheapest of all of them. So everybody's going to biodiesel in Germany. and they're growing crops of it. And as I took the train from Stadtstanach back to Frankfurt, and this was, I think, 3 weekends ago when Peter B. Collins filled in for me that Monday and Friday. It's because I left right after I got off the air on Thursday, flew to Germany, arrived on Friday. I was there over the weekend and then flew back home on Monday and came back on the air on Tuesday. As I took the train from Stadtstanach back to Frankfurt, it was about a five-hour train ride going from the east to the west across Germany. And I was sitting on the right side of the train, and I'm looking up. I'm looking north. And so all the roofs of the houses that I'm looking at are the south-facing roofs. And every single town, I mean, little tiny towns with 30 houses in them, and great big cities like Würzburg that we took the train through, every fourth or fifth house had solar panels on the roof. It is just exploding across that country. We could be doing the same thing here. And I said, Samuel, where are you buying these solar panels from? And he says, well, we were buying them from a French company, but the Chinese just bought up the French company and exported the factory to China. They dismantled the factory, took it to China, and rebuilt it there. And I said, I can't believe it. The French would let them get away with that. You know, the French are very protective of their industries. And he said they had to do it under WTO rules. So now we find, you know, China and Japan and South Korea getting big into this. We could be doing this. We could be doing this. It would take, you know, just a little bit of help from government, from we the people collectively, like they're doing in Germany, and we could be doing this. But we're not. We are not. Me. Welcome back, my friends. 14 minutes past the hour. Jeff in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hey, Jeff. Welcome. What's up?
Hey, Tom. It was a great day when you got full-time on Pittsburgh on WPTT.
Yeah, I'm very pleased to be there, and thank you for listening on that station.
And I have a real quick comment and then also kind of a little bit of story. I agree with you in general about foreign investors buying up our industry. I got to correct you, and I'm surprised you didn't see it.
Citgo?
Citgo is not Dutch.
Well,
Citgo is Venezuelan. It's, you know, the nationalized Venezuelan oil company.
Right.
And it just kind of undermines your credibility just a little bit. Who knows, the lines might have got skewed on the website that you were looking at.
Well, I think it must be a part of it, because here's the Alex just shared me this from Citgo's investor relations comment. Headquartered in Houston, Texas, Citgo is owned by PDV America, Inc., an indirect, wholly owned subsidiary of Petrolas de Venezuela S.A., the national oil company of the Bolivarian Republic of Venezuela. On the other hand, some portion of Citgo was sold in the last 10 years to PROPERNYNBV of the Netherlands for $662 million. Obviously, it wasn't the whole thing, but it was a piece of it. Just like I said, you know, a piece of Monsanto was sold to BHP Petroleum in Australia for $745 million. You're right, though, yeah. The majority of Citgo would be worth a whole lot more than $600 million. Thank you for the
recently
correction.
Here outside of Pittsburgh, there's a plant called Shippingsport.
Yeah.
It was the first nuclear power plant in the world. It was built by Westinghouse. And so they recently refurbished part of it.
Westinghouse, by the way, is a British company.
And, Westinghouse is, most of their nuclear got, or most of their, I guess, consumer electronics got bought up by Siemens. But nevertheless, the Shippingsport plant, they recently refurbished it. And I was just made to read, the story was basically about how they had to take all this equipment all the way up the Mississippi River and then up the Ohio River to get to Shippingsport. But all the equipment had to be made, I think it was made in the Netherlands,
yeah.
Because we do not have the technology to make that equipment here in the United States now.
That's the tragedy. Jeff, you put your finger right on it. And it's, yeah.
That's good work, Tom. Thanks.
Thank you. Thanks, Jeff. Thanks for the call. That is the tragedy of these insane trade policies. 16 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back, my friends. 21 minutes past the hour. Your light at the end of the tunnel at Talk Radio. The No Boring Zone here, the Tom Hartman Radio Program. Our program brought to you today by Small Dog Electronics, 1-800-511-MAX, 1-800-511-MACS, smalldog.com for all things Macintosh, all things computer. Give them a call. Tell them I said hi. Great folks. We've been checking this whole thing out here for Alex Goldmark, in fact, our intrepid board operator and master engineer there at Air America in New York, who mixes together the program, tracked it down. And apparently what's happened is that, yes, part of Citgo's holdings in the United States have been acquired by a Dutch company, but that Dutch company is owned by another part of Citgo in Venezuela, or the Venezuelan company. In fact, they say this complex organizational scheme underlying PDVSA's international refining and marketing operations is presented in the graph G1. Anyhow, they go through this whole list. But, yeah. Anyhow, no need to belabor the point. I think the larger point is, detail aside, that America is being sold. We are on the verge of the largest automaker in America being Toyota. And again, you will find cons out there who say, oh, everything is fine. Everything is just fine. And, this is called insourcing. Isn't this marvelous? Isn't it a great thing? I have seen representatives from the Bush administration and both Republicans and Democrats, these so-called free trade advocates, saying, oh, I think it's marvelous that foreign companies are buying up our industries and hiring our workers because they're giving us jobs. Well, I'm sorry. Number one, nobody ever gives anybody a job. Doesn't happen. Companies don't hire people because they're looking for an opportunity to pass out money. The closest you could get to that is something like the WPA that Roosevelt did to get us out of the Great Depression, to put the money into hands of the working people of America who were unemployed so that they would spend that money so that they would generate demand, which would get us out of the Depression. But companies don't make jobs. Companies have products or services for which they have identified a demand. People want to buy things, and so they need to make them. And so they need to hire somebody to make them or do the work. And the only reason that a company will hire somebody is because they know that they can make more than that person costs. If you run a company and you're going to hire somebody for $20,000 a year, you better make sure that they're going to earn you at least $21,000. Or really probably more like 30 or 40 or 50,000, because you got to cover all the overhead costs associated with it and everything else. Companies don't make jobs. Companies hire people to provide them with labor, with intellectual or physical capacity. Pure and simple. We need to completely reframe this thing. Up until the time Reagan came along, everybody in America understood this. And now, it's like, well, we need to give tax breaks to these people so they'll create jobs. Yeah, right. They're not going to create jobs because of taxes. You want to create jobs? Give the average working person in America who spends 100% of their income a little more money by increasing the minimum wage, and they will spend more money, and that will create more demand, and then the businesses will say, hey, wait a minute, we need to run this assembly line at 110% of capacity instead of 90% of capacity. We're going to have to start paying overtime. We're going to have to hire some more people. And suddenly you've created jobs. It's called economics. It's called economics 101. Supply-side economics, trickle-down economics, Lafler curve, all this stuff has been so thoroughly discredited, it's laughable, and all you have to do is look at the state of the American economy right now to see that in the 25 years from the time that Ronald Reagan came into office and began this insane trade policies and these insane economic policies, we have gone from becoming the leading nation in the world economically to becoming becoming the world's largest creditor, more countries owed us more money than any other country in the world, to becoming the world's largest debtor. We owe other countries more money than any other country in the world. We have gone from becoming the world's largest importer of raw materials and exporter of finished goods. In other words, we would bring into this country this ore, and we'd make steel, and we'd make cars, and we would sell those cars, to becoming the world's largest importer of finished goods and exporter of raw materials like wood and trash. And we're basically being strip mined. We have become a third world country as a result of this nutso plan. Dan, Atlanta, Georgia. Hey, Dan, welcome to the program. We have about a minute before we got to take a break. What's on your mind? Dan?
Hello?
Yeah, you're live and on the air.
Yes, I had a couple of questions, and I'll have to listen to them after midnight tonight because I have Sirius. But the first question is, what can these politicians possibly expect from what they are doing to this nation?
They expect big campaign contributions from the corporations who are benefiting. Pure and simple.
it's almost traitorous to what they're doing to this
country. I agree. I think it's treason.
And
that's why a lot of folks refer to them as Benedict Arnold corporations.
And the second question is, with all of these forces, you have the WTO, you have the split of the Democratic National, the Democratic Party from the DLC, and
Don, let me. This is a good question and a good topic. Let me put you on hold, and we'll just pick this up on the other side of the break because I would like to have this conversation with you. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program. 27 minutes past the hour. We'll be right back.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
What did you learn in school today, dear little boy of mine? What did you learn in school today, dear little boy of mine? I learned that Washington never told a lie. I learned that soldiers seldom die. I learned that everybody's free, and that's what the teacher said to me. And that's what I learned in school today. That's what I learned in school. And what did you learn in school today, dear little boy of mine? What did you learn in school today, dear little boy of mine? I learned that policemen are my friends. I learned that justice never ends. I learned that murderers die for the crimes, even if we make a mistake sometimes. That's what I learned in school today. That's what I learned in school.
And welcome back, my friends. 25 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. The place where smart people get their news. The True People's Radio Program. Economic Policy Institute. Economic Snapshots. I just have to share this with you very quickly before we go back to Don in Atlanta's question and wrap that one. On March 10th of last year, George W. Bush said, and I quote, "When politicians in Washington attack trade for political reasons, they don't mention these workers at the new Honda plants in Ohio or the 6.4 million other American workers who draw their paychecks from foreign companies." In other words, insourcing is a good thing. Now, you would think that a guy who had run a bunch of businesses would realize that the profit from a company has to go someplace, and it goes to the owners. And if the owners are outside the United States, then all the benefit from the labor of those 6.4 million workers is leaving this country. It's not staying in this country. But he probably doesn't realize that because every single company that George W. Bush started failed. One had to be bailed out by his father's business partners. Another one had to be bailed out by Osama bin Laden's half-brother, Salim bin Laden. And then when they started to investigate that thing a few years later, Salim bin Laden mysteriously died in the crash of a small airplane in Texas. So anyhow, that's George W. Bush. House Speaker Newt Gingrich, he says, and I quote, insourcing works. This is foreign companies coming to the United States, buying up our businesses and hiring our people. He says, insourcing works when the next company, the next entrepreneur, the next investor decides that America is the place to create the best high-value jobs. If America has a powerful engine of insourcing, it will create so many good jobs that, as in the past, few will even notice the jobs that are moving to foreign lands. Yeah. Year and a half ago, Newt Gingrich and then the Economic Policy Institute, which is at epinet.org, then they go through and they look at the employment patterns of foreign-owned companies. And it turns out that foreign-owned companies are just about half as likely as American-owned companies to actually increase employment as business increases. Instead, they simply move it to other parts of the world. I mean, they're looking for cheap labor, too. Back to Don in Atlanta. Don, you were midway through a sentence or through a question there. Go for it.
Okay, Tom, Jesus, pal, this is insidious.
I know.
Pardon
my interrupting you, Don, but I got to say, you know, back in the 1950s, the 1960s, the very early 1960s, when I was a teenager, before I was a teenager even, I remember when I was like 11, 12 years old, something like that, going to a John Birch Society meeting with the dad of a friend of mine who was, like, really into it. And I remember reading John Stormer's book, None Dare Call It Treason. I think I must have been 12 because in 64 I was 13 and I went door to door for Barry Goldwater. I mean, I really got into this stuff. And I was convinced the commies were coming to get us and that the United Nations was a communist plot to take over, you know, the world, right? And there's a lot of people who still believe that. I mean, I woke up within 2 years of that. I got off to college when I was 16 years old and figured out that within a year they were going to draft me and send my butt over to Vietnam and kill me. And just didn't seem like a good idea to me, not just out of personal survival instinct, but just generally speaking. And had my political awakening, as it were, at that young age, or reawakening. But the fact of the matter is that there is an institution out there which is a surrender of sovereignty. And it's not the United Nations. Yes, we do surrender some sovereignty in small ways to the United Nations, but it always has to do with whether or not we have the right to wage war. In other words, the UN is an institution that's designed to create peace. But economic sovereignty, we have surrendered economic sovereignty with all these treaties, because the Constitution says that when you sign a treaty, it becomes the law of the land. And the treaty supersedes the law of the land. So if we have a law that says that if you're going to catch tuna, you have to do it in a way that doesn't kill dolphins, which we did have as a law, And then we sign a treaty with the World Trade Organization, or NAFTA, that says you can't restrict foreign trade. And Mexico says, well, we want to sell tuna in the United States, but we kill dolphins, and we don't have any law against that. Then they can sue us and say, you got to do away with your law, which is exactly what happened, by the way, for example. So, you know, pardon my going off on another rant here, Don. Eventually, I'll let you ask this question. Go for it.
No problem, buddy. I love listening to you. With all these forces, you have a media which doesn't report what is happening.
Well, they're part of it. The media is part of this.
Yeah.
I mean, the largest publishers in America aren't even owned by Americans.
I know. and then you have the corporations. You have the WTO. You have the DLC. You have the Republicans. The question comes, can we even turn it around?
I believe we can. I believe we can for two reasons. Number one, because what we're talking about, Don, what you and I are talking about right now, is what's right and true and honest. And eventually, my experience has been that's usually what wins out. And, you know, sometimes it takes generations, but eventually that's usually what wins out. And number two, enormous numbers of Americans are starting to wake up to this. You look at the electoral victories of progressives, like the governor of Montana, or Bernie Sanders, as the member of Congress from Vermont. Vermont's actually, you know, everybody says, oh, liberal Vermont. Vermont's a pretty actually conservative state. Most of Vermont's very rural. And you know, you've heard Bernie on this program. You know what he's about. When people speak the truth, when people just come right out and say, here's the honest truth, we're talking here about the economic surrender of the United States, not to, you know, the nasty Germans, the nasty Japanese, or the nasty Russians, or pick your country du jour, you know, whoever's going to be your enemy this week, but the surrender to a small band of, frankly, probably fewer than 500 large multinational corporations. People go, yeah, I can see it happening, because they are seeing it happening in their paychecks. They're seeing it happening in their workplace. They're seeing it happening all across America. Now you've got folks like Lou Dobbs, the Republican, you know, the proud Republican Lou Dobbs, talking about this on CNN. I mean, it is, Americans are waking up, Don. And that's, you know, my hope is that they will continue to. I think, you know, that keep in mind, the civil rights movement didn't happen overnight. But, you know, once it got momentum, once it started going, it happened. It's still obviously an ongoing process, but it happened. The women's rights movement. We have, in fact, you look back 7,000 years of civilized history. This is the power of people waking up, Don. 7,000 years of the history of civilization. You go back from the Epic of Gilgamesh, written 7,000 years ago, the oldest known written, you know, manuscript, written, by the way, in what is now Iraq. It was then called Uruk. The beginnings of civilization, from then up until literally 200 years ago, most of the people in the world agreed that it was appropriate for humans to own other humans and call them slaves, and that it was appropriate for men to own women as if they were slaves. And it's in the Bible, it's in the New Testament, it's in the Old Testament, it's in the Quran, everybody agreed on this. And 200 years ago, a small number of people, you know, the Enlightenment era. You know, John Locke and Rousseau started writing about this in the 1600s. And in the 1700s, you had the Enlightenment politicians like Jefferson and Franklin. And they came along and they said, hey, wait a minute, that's a weird, sick, twisted idea. And boom. We out of you know, after 7,000 years of everybody agreeing that the country should be ruled by kings, popes, or the rich, we had a country that was ruled by we the people, a radical idea. And then within 200 years, after 7,000 years of everybody agreeing that humans should be the property of other humans as slaves or as women the property of men, we said, those are sick ideas. And we have awakened that rapidly. And I think that the ability of communication that we have, things like this talk radio program right now, the internet and all this, communication is making that awakening happening so much faster. And it on the one hand, it enabled them to grab our country so fast, you know, with the WTO and all this. But I think it's going to come back. Don, I'm very hopeful, frankly. So
well, thank you, Tom.
I hope I've answered your question.
I'll tell you what, buddy, you bring a smile to my face every time you come on.
Well, Don, I got to say, if we're going to make this happen, it's going to take all of us. Activism begins with you. Tag, you're it, buddy. Pass it along, okay?
Okay.
Okay. Talk to you later. Bonnie in Burgistown, Pennsylvania. Hey, Bonnie, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Happy New Year, Tom.
Well, thank you, and the same to you, Bonnie.
Thank you. I have a couple questions, so I'm hoping you can let me hold on in the break, too, so I can cover both of my questions. By the way, your credibility is never shaken with me because you aren't some stubborn boy king who thinks he's infallible. You admit whenever you're incorrect or you fine-tune your answer after doing some research.
Blow something, I'm not going to...
Yeah. Well, that's what separates the adults from children and liberals from neocons.
Yeah, well, thank you, Bonnie.
I have a couple of questions.
Okay.
Can you
toss them out quickly, please?
I remember in the 80s when the developing world had the problem of capital flight to here in the United States, and the banks here were discounting the currencies of those countries.
Right.
And this country's never had a well-developed market because they had a micro-small middle class, which delighted the executives of the big companies because they went to those countries for the cheap source of power,
third-world
labor.
Countries. Right, yeah.
So I have two questions. My first is, can the American dollar be discounted also, and or will the interest rates rise on the obscene national debt that has really accumulated under W? And I have another question.
Yeah, okay. The answer to both your questions is yes.
Yeah.
You know, I can expand on that, but yeah, you're going to see interest rates going up because it's going to be increasingly hard for us to sell our debt as we become more and more bankrupt.
And that makes our middle class even smaller.
That's right. And it is possible for W to just run the printing presses. In fact, they just announced that they're no longer going to publish the M3 numbers, which are the numbers of M3 is the number of total. The total generation of cash, basically. You know, how fast the printing presses are running. And they're just not going to do that anymore. But thanks a lot for the call. It's great to hear from you. It's 45 minutes past the hour. The Tom Hartman radio program, where we dare to ask, is Walmart a person? And we dare to say, no, don't think so.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Well, I was in the car and I heard this guy. He sounded all shook up and he told me why. His voice was a-shaking on the EIB. Sounded like an Oxycontin eater to me. It was a bug-eyed, tone-deaf, flying Oxycontin eater.
Right-wing
strung-out hypocrite prescription cheater. Rush looks strange to me.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you. 50 minutes past the hour. Coming up on 9 minutes before the top of the hour. 1-866-440-8466. Our telephone number across the United States. TomHartman.com if you want to drop into our live chat room and say hi to all the folks there. Harvey in Tacoma, Washington on the line. Hey, Harvey, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom, I just want to wish you happy holidays from the front lines on the war on Christmas. And,
okay. You mean the war on good manners? I have concluded that, you know, there is a war around this, and it's a war on good manners, and it's being waged by Fox News. They want everybody to stick their face in somebody else's face and yell Merry Christmas, regardless of what that person's religion may be.
Yeah, I find that very, very distasteful. But anyway, I just wanted to... Let you know that the history of electronic eavesdropping with the Republican Party is nothing new Apparently, during the Bull Moose campaign of Theodore Roosevelt, they did wiretap into his phone lines and gathered information on his campaign that way.
Incredible. So this would have been the election of what, 1912 was that?
1912, the one that Wilson got elected in.
Yeah.
And this is just something that I don't think that people quite understand just how right wing these people are, and they
that's what had happened was, see, Teddy Roosevelt, and for those who don't remember or obviously none of our listeners are old enough to remember, but those who never studied it, Teddy Roosevelt was vice president when McKinley was president. McKinley was his right hand man was a guy who Karl Rove says, Mark Hanna was his name, who Karl Rove says he's fashioned his job after. Mark Hanna was the original political handler. And he figured that McKinley needed a war to get reelected. And so basically they engineered the Spanish-American War along with a little help from Mr. Hearst. And McKinley died, as I recall, he died of a heart attack, or was he assassinated? I don't remember which it was. He was assassinated. Okay, yeah. And Teddy Roosevelt became president and then ran for reelection as president. And he was the Republican Roosevelt. He was a Republican president and through the early 1900s, did a pretty good job. But he was becoming more and more progressive. And, he ultimately left the party. And then he came back, and in that election that you're talking about, here's Teddy Roosevelt, now a full-blown progressive, challenging his own Republican Party and actually splitting the Republican vote, because a lot of Republicans, were still holding to the ideals of Lincoln, because, even though it had been 60 years earlier, the original Republican Party started in Jackson, Michigan in 1856, was a progressive party. It was a response to corruption in the Democratic Party and the death of the Whigs. But it got corrupted in the 1880s, and Teddy Roosevelt would have nothing to do with it. And so you had the most corrupt of the Republicans running against Teddy Roosevelt and against Woodrow Wilson, who was the Democrat who ultimately won. And you say they wiretapped Teddy Roosevelt. I'm not surprised.
They did, yes. And it's just, like I say, it's something that if people understand, that's something that we should make sure that gets out there. Another thing is we progressive have to reclaim that word reform.
Yeah.
We need to reclaim that word reform and show what reform really is, because that's what progressives are. We are reformers.
There you go. There you go. And conservationists we have a conservative position, although we are not conservatives, let's say. Interesting distinction.
It's been fun talking to you.
Yeah.
Harvey. And like I say, happy holidays.
Thank you. And the same to you, Harvey, and a happy new year as well. Great to hear from you. I appreciate it. Myrna in Puyallup, Washington. Hey, Myrna.
Hi, Tom. I just wanted to, 2 days ago, you said something about, and I didn't hear all of it, about seeds that could not be taken from in Iraq, could not be taken from their own plants and saving their seeds.
Right.
What was that all about? We have a seed company. We send thousands of dollars of our seeds from our season before to Haiti and to other third world countries. I'm wondering, what was that?
We're actually doing this all over the world, Myrna, but we changed their constitution to recognize our patent laws so that if an American seed company grows or develops a seed, whether they do it through genetic engineering or through hybridization, whatever, they can patent that seed. They can patent a life form. So if a farmer grows that plant and then decides to keep the seeds from, traditionally farmers do this. They've been doing that in that part of the world for 7,000 years. If the farmer keeps those seeds and plants them the next year, then that company, Monsanto's probably the largest, can come in and have that person arrested for theft.
Oh, my gosh.
They've got to buy new seeds from the seed company every year. And
that is outrageous.
Yeah. Well, the farmers of Iraq think so, too, and it's one of the reasons, it's one of many reasons why they're shooting at our soldiers.
Okay, well, what can be done?
Well, what can be done is we can give Iraq back to the Iraqis. And yeah. You know, there are progressives in Iraq who are going to say, you know, enough of this already. Paul Bremer came in, and he thought he was going to create a neocon paradise. He banned labor unions. He put in a flat income tax rate of 15%. So the taxi driver is paying the same tax as the multibillionaire. It has led to, and it's brought about an economic disaster, an absolute economic disaster. Anybody in Iraq with a net worth more than probably $300,000 to $400,000, you know, anybody who's the wealthy in Iraq, they've all gone to Jordan. There's this huge Iraqi expatriate community in Jordan and in other surrounding countries where all the people with wealth have gone and are being welcomed with open arms, by the way, I might add. And what's left is basically the working class in Iraq. And the working class in Iraq has a 50% unemployment rate. And the money that we're giving to Halliburton and Bechtel to rebuild the country, if we simply handed it to the government of Iraq and said, here's some cash, hire people, instead of paying Halliburton $150,000 a year to hire a guy, you can hire an Iraqi for $500 a year, Iraq would be rebuilt. It's 57 minutes past the hour.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
Remember Michael Luttig? Michael Luttig, he was the judge in the 4th District Court of Appeals out of Richmond, Virginia. Conservative. Republican. My recollection is that he was appointed by Reagan, I could be wrong, who was one of the 5 or 6 finalists that everybody was considering would be one of the guys that George W. Bush may pick for the Supreme Court back when John Roberts ended up getting the nod. And then his name came up again when Harriet Myers was being considered, and his name came up again when Sam Scalito. Sam Alito came forward. Michael J. Luttig, the conservative, arch-conservative, Republican judge in the 4th District Court of Appeals in Richmond, Virginia. Now, the 4th Court, by the way, welcome back to the program, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you, coming up on 7 minutes past the hour. Our phone number, 866-440-8466. That's 440-THOM. Website, if you want to drop into our live chat room, tomhartman.com. T-H-O-M, Hartman with two N's, although however you spell it should get you there. Anyhow, Michael Luttig he has almost always sided with the Bush administration on pretty much everything. I mean, when they want something done, they go to the 4th Court of Appeals. It's their, the Washington Post refers to it as their court of choice for terrorism issues. So, Jose Padilla, and you would think his name would be pronounced Padilla, but the Spanish pronunciation would be Padilla, but he has asked that it be pronounced Padilla. That's his pronunciation of it. Jose Padilla, who was arrested 3 years ago, and has not yet been charged with a crime. 3 years ago, and not yet charged with a crime. And, you know, let me remind you that the Fifth Amendment to the Constitution says, no person shall be held to answer for a capital or otherwise infamous crime unless on presentment or indictment of a grand jury. Nor shall any person nor be compelled in a criminal case to be a witness against himself, nor be deprived of life, liberty, or property without due process of law. Fifth Amendment. In other words, if somebody's going to put you in jail, they have to prove why you have to be, even if it's to be held in jail before trial. The Fifth Amendment. The Sixth Amendment. In all criminal prosecutions, the accused shall enjoy the right to a speedy and public trial by an impartial jury of the state and district, blah, 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 to be confronted with witnesses against him, to have compulsory process for obtaining witnesses in his favor, and to have the assistance of counsel for his defense. That's the Sixth Amendment. The Seventh Amendment. No fact tried by a jury shall be otherwise reexamined in any court of the United States. The right of trial by jury shall be preserved. The Eighth Amendment. Excessive bail shall not be required, nor excessive fines imposed, nor cruel and unusual punishments inflicted. There you have the Fifth, Sixth, Seventh, and Eighth Amendments. Four amendments to the Constitution saying nobody in the United States has the right to simply grab somebody off the street and throw them in jail without going before a judge and demonstrating at least some evidence that this person has committed a crime. And then they have to quickly, in a speedy fashion, they have to provide them with a trial. George W. Bush has said no. Imperius Rex. I am the king. And by virtue of the divine right of kings, I can put people in prison. These Reichwingers came up with this new designation, enemy combatant. It's not the old prisoner of war. Prisoners of war have rights under the Geneva Conventions, to which we are signatory, by and large. There's pieces of it we haven't signed. But certainly the parts that say, they talk about prisoners of war. And if they're not a prisoner of war, then they have the rights of criminal defendants, regardless of the crime they've been charged. Even the most horrific crimes. Jeffrey Dahmer had a trial. I mean, you get people who eat people get trials in the United States. Charlie Manson had a trial. And so here George W. Bush comes along and says, nope, I have the right to simply snatch this guy in Chicago and hide him away and not let him talk to a lawyer and not let him come before a court and not present any evidence against him. But I'm going to go on TV and I'm going to tell everybody that he's trying to build a dirty bomb, a radiological weapon. And that'll scare the bejesus out of everybody and they'll instantly hate him and they'll all say, oh, good for you. You're protecting us from a bad guy. And a year goes by. And 2 years go by, and 3 years go by. And this, by the way, this guy's an American citizen. In other words, this could happen just as easily to you or me. In fact, the initial evidence that had been presented that indicated that Jose Padilla may be interested in a dirty bomb was that he had been surfing a website which showed how to build one. What websites have you visited lately? On the basis of, apparently on the basis of this, because it was never put before us and it was never put before a court, it was simply leaked into the media by the administration. On the basis of this, Jose Padilla was arrested. He wasn't actually arrested. Arrest is a lawful procedure. This is unlawful. He was seized and thrown into a cell and denied counsel, denied a lawyer. I mean, it's just a clear violation of the Constitution. So a year goes by, 2 years go by, 3 years go by. Finally, coming up on the 4 years of this, and the Supreme Court is asked to rule whether George is king or not, whether the third George to rule to be the president of the United States. George Washington, George Bush Sr., George Bush Jr. here, whether the third George should have the same rights that King George III of England was claiming when we said to him, no, I don't think so, and signed the Declaration of Independence against the third George who ruled England. And so in order to stop the Supreme Court from taking this case, the Bush administration all of a sudden says, stop. He's no longer an enemy combatant. We're not doing that with him. He is now a criminal. And by the way, we're not going to charge him with dirty bombs. We don't have any evidence of that. But we do think that maybe back in 1993, when he was a gang member who was converting to Islam, he might have had some association with a group that was raising money that was going to the Middle East that might have helped terrorists. So we would like him moved into a civilian court and tried under the Constitution. This was absolutely transparently an attempt on the part of the Bush administration to avoid having their sorry butts, that is George W. Bush's, dragged in front of the Supreme Court, where the Supreme Court might say, no, George, you are not king, and you do not have the power to do this, in which case he would have to release everybody in Guantanamo Bay, because basically you can't run a concentration camp. Sorry, this is America, not Germany in the 1930s. And who knows how many people have actually disappeared. I mean, we know about Padilla because it got leaked into the media. We also know that there are thousands of people missing in this country, and we have no idea who they are or where they are. Who knows how many people George W. Bush has hidden away. So anyhow, I started out by telling you about this judge that Bush had been considered, Michael Luttig. Michael Luttig just ruled against George W. Bush, his buddy, the guy he was considering for the Supreme Court. Or maybe that was all a show just to get him to suck up to George W. Whatever. In any case, he went before Michael Luttig's court, the Fourth District Court of Appeals in Richmond, and said, we'd like to move Padilla from military custody as an enemy combatant, even though he was not seized on the battlefield, he was seized in Chicago, and he's an American citizen. We'd like to move him from military custody into civilian custody and try him in the courts. And in the Fourth District Court of Appeals, they said, no, we are not going to participate in this charade. The Republican judge said, we are not going to participate in this charade. When I share with you the exact quotes from this judge and from this court, it's going to blow your mind. And I'm telling you, this is the case. This is a huge, big deal. Because the Padilla case is testing whether or not George Bush is king or is president. And Bush is trying to spin it some other way, and we'll see. It's 16 minutes past the hour.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
So let me untangle this thing for you. Welcome back, my friends, by the way. 21 minutes past the hour. News without conflicts of global corporate interest, the Tom Hartman radio program. A lot of people reading this article in the New York Times by Eric Lichtblau, and it's being picked up by wire services and newspapers all over the United States. This and variations of it, of course. It's fairly dense, and without the background, without the history I just shared, you may not get it. Understand, you know, what's this talking about? So let's just deconstruct this, because what's happening here could be the end of the imperial presidency that George Bush has been trying to construct, or it could be the end of representative democracy if Bush wins, and the beginning of an imperial presidency that really is an imperial presidency, and, you know, the Constitution of the United States no longer matters. Frankly, I don't think even the right-wingers on the courts, as we just saw here with Michael Luttig, I don't think that these guys are going to let him do it. So here's the story as the New York Times plays it, and they're just running it right down the middle. Without the background that I've shared with you so far, the Bush administration asked the Supreme Court today to allow for the immediate transfer of Jose Padilla from a military brig to civilian custody to stand trial on terrorism charges, challenging an appellate court ruling last week that blocked the move. Now, you get this? They went to an appellate court last week and they said, they went to a court and they said, take this guy. And the court said, no, we're not going to take him. So they took it. So they went to an appellate court. Michael Luttig, good buddy of George Bush, was going to be nominated to be on the Supreme Court, and said, order this court to take the Padilla case. And Michael Luttig, well, the court, the Fourth Circuit Court, says no. In fact, here's from the New York Times. As Eric Lichtbauer writes, the Fourth Circuit is widely known as one of the most conservative appellate courts in the country, and it has sided with the Bush administration on a number of key matters involving terrorism and national security. Indeed, in a September ruling in the Padilla case, The Fourth Circuit affirmed President Bush's power to hold Padilla, a former Chicago gang member, as an enemy combatant tied to al-Qaeda. That opinion was written by Judge Michael J. Luttig, whom President Bush considered for recent Supreme Court nominees, and it was also Judge Luttig who wrote last week's opinion blocking Padilla's transfer. He has turned the he has flipped around and said nothing. Bush, no, ain't gonna happen. As they say, well, here back to the article, the beginning of the article, the Justice Department. So now Bush has to go to the Supreme Court to say, you know, the Fourth Circuit won't do it. You've got to do it. And I'm telling you, this could be their undoing, or it could, we'll see. We'll see where John Roberts stands on this, and we'll see how quickly they can try and they're going to try and get Alito in before this thing is decided. I guarantee you that, because Alito never saw government power he didn't love. Eric Lichtblau goes on, the Justice Department, in an unusually strong criticism of a lower court that has historically been a staunch ally, said the earlier order blocking Mr. Padilla's transfer to civilian custody represented an unwarranted attack on presidential discretion. Right. This was last week that the Fourth Circuit did this. Now, here's where it gets, this is incredible. This is what the appeals court said. This is what the judge said that Bush wanted to put in the Supreme Court. This is what the appeals court said and why the Bush administration is now having to try to go over their head to the Supreme Court. Again, quoting from the New York Times, Eric Lichtblau's article, the appeals court said that the Bush administration, in charging Mr. Padilla in criminal court in November, after jailing him for more than 3.5 years as an enemy combatant without charges, gave the appearance that it was trying to manipulate the court system to prevent the Supreme Court from hearing the case, and it warned that the maneuvering could harm the administration's credibility in the courts. You get this? The Bush administration but Solicitor General Paul D. Clement, this is now Bush's guy, right, says, okay, we don't agree, we're going to take it to the Supreme Court. And he said the Fourth Circuit's decision defies both law and logic. In unusually caustic language, the Solicitor General said that the Fourth Circuit did not have the authority to disregard a presidential directive. What? The judicial doesn't have the authority to disregard something that the president says that is unconstitutional? And he said its decision blocking Mr. Padilla's transfer is, I'm quoting now, quoting from the Solicitor General, you know, attacking this decision. He says, it's based on a mischaracterization of events and an unwarranted attack on the exercise of executive discretion, and if given effect would raise profound separation of powers concerns. They are trying to tell us that black is white, up is down, left is right, and that, no, we don't live in a constitutional democracy. We just say we do. We actually live in a kingdom, and the king is George. George III. All hail. In bringing criminal charges for the first time against Mr. Padilla last month, the administration, again the New York Times, reversed course and accused him of working to support violent jihad causes in Afghanistan and elsewhere from 1993 to 2001. The criminal charges make no mention of the dirty bomb or any other attacks on America. So, you know, here you have the conservative Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals saying that George Bush is manipulating the court system to avoid having to go before the Supreme Court and possibly have his assertion that he is George Rex, George the King, attacked, and that this is harming the credibility of the courts and of the president. Amen. 27 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Hallelujah, dads and mommies, cowboys, rebels, yanks, and commies, buy yourselves some real red-blooded fun. If you want to make the grade, you've got to have a hand grenade and a fully automatic GI gun. Nice. So buy a gun for your son right away, sir. Shake his hand like a man and let him play, sir. let his little mind expand. Place a weapon in his hand, for the skills he learns today will someday pay, sir.
And welcome back, my friends. 25 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. We're talking about, I just wanted to get into this a little bit and help you kind of deconstruct it, because there's a lot of history in this thing, and there's a lot of subtlety in it, and very little of it is contained in these short news pieces, and certainly not on television news and radio news, where the story has to be condensed down to 2.5 minutes or 1 minute at you know, 30 seconds at the most, and in some cases in radio news, 10, 12 seconds. George W. Bush has gone before the Supreme Court to ask the Supreme Court to overturn the Fourth District Court's ruling that says that he has to follow through with Padilla being an enemy combatant and prove that, or, well, actually, there wasn't an or, that they won't hand him over to civilian authorities, that the Bush administration hasn't demonstrated a case in their mind, apparently. And, in fact, the Fourth Circuit Court's saying that it gives the appearance that Bush is trying to manipulate the court system to prevent the Supreme Court from hearing the case. Because Padilla's case was going, you know, may have gone before the Supreme Court. Supreme Court had said, yes, we'll accept this. We will take a look at this case. And all of a sudden, Bush says, oh, never mind. So now, here's the supreme irony. Bush is going to the Supreme Court to ask the Supreme Court to overrule the Fourth Circuit Court, which ruled the way it did because they said that Bush has tried to avoid going to the Supreme Court. But because we're talking about two different issues of law here, he might be able to get the Supreme Court to rule that the Fourth Circuit Court was wrong in trying to prevent him from going to the Supreme Court, and thus he won't have to go to the Supreme Court. Can you imagine? It's starting to sound like it's starting to sound like Don Rumsfeld. You know, there are the known knowns, there are the unknown knowns. It's the unknown knowns that we have to. And now, this Padilla's lawyer, she's Donna Newman, one of his lawyers, she says, nothing in this case surprises me anymore. She said, this is incredible, right? That the Fourth Circuit Court is ruling against Bush. And so now Bush is going to the Supreme Court to fight his own conservative court. But now it gets even weirder. Lawyers in a number of other cases, some of which apparently are actual, real bad guys. Right, for example, in an Oregon case, you got seven people, six men and a woman, mostly American Muslims. This also by Eric Lichtbaum and James Rise, the New York Times Service. Eventually charged as part of a terrorism-related prosecution that became to be known as the Portland Seven. These folks traveled from Portland to Western China before disbanding in the face of visa problems and Chinese border troops. All have pled guilty and been sentenced, except for one. And that one was killed in a gun battle with Pakistani troops. In other words, here you've got some people who have confessed that they were about terror. And that's just, you know, one of several. And they're now saying, you know, if the information that was used to arrest us was obtained illegally, you can't keep us in jail. And so we've got Bush out there saying, oh, no, it's perfectly legal for me to have the National Security Agency wiretap people without a court warrant, court order. And yet people over at the NSA were saying, you know, have said to the New York Times, on the record, but without, you know, naming names, have said there's people here very, very uncomfortable. You've got one of the judges of the FISA court quit over this, just resigned over this, saying, sorry, this is not a kingdom. This is the question. This is the question before us right now. Is the United States of America a kingdom, and is George W. Bush its king? Or are we a constitutionally limited democratic republic that operates by the rule of law and the supreme law of the land being the Constitution of the United States, which, by the way, the president swore to uphold and defend? He didn't swear when he took his oath of office to protect and defend you and me. I know he goes on TV and he says, my job, I swore I would protect the American people. No, he didn't. The oath of office is right there in Article 2, Section 2 of the Constitution of the United States, where it says that the President of the United States shall swear an oath or affirmation that he will protect and defend the Constitution of the United States. Period. End of sentence. There is no sentence that follows that, that says, and also he has to protect the people. Because the assumption is if the Constitution is intact, then the people are in charge and the people can figure out how to protect themselves. Thank you very much. We don't need no stinking kings. And this Padilla case is about whether or not this is a kingdom or a democracy. It is that simple. And making it and highlighting it, throwing it into stark relief, showing how clearly showing what this is all about, is now this NSA wiretapping thing, where you've got Bush saying, and it could have been any other agency, could have been the FBI, that's who it was for Nixon, could have been the CIA, Nixon did it with the CIA too. We don't know, maybe Nixon did it with the NSA. Back when Nixon was around, it was a federal crime for a federal employee to mention the fact that the NSA existed. It was that secret. So Nixon may have compromised the NSA too, for all we know, and just, you know, nobody was allowed to talk about it out loud in Congress. But here we have George W. Bush saying that he has the right to completely ignore the 5th, 6th, 7th, and 8th Amendments to the Constitution of the United States, in large part the Constitution itself, simply because he's president. He has redefined the meaning of president. And now here it comes. Defense lawyers, and this is the New York Times, the defense lawyers in some of the country's biggest terrorism cases say they plan to bring legal challenges to determine whether the National Security Agency used illegal wiretaps against several dozen Muslims tied to Al-Qaeda. We're not saying allegedly. We're not saying, you know, these are the actual bad guys. You know, in West Bamboozle, Georgia, if the local district attorney or if the local chief of police went out and just arrested somebody and threw him in jail and pistol whipped him and just kept him there for 6 months or so and then drags him out and says, okay, you can go now. The people, you know, the smallest, most retrograde town in America, people would say, hey, wait a minute. We're at least not going to reelect this guy. No, I'm sorry. This is not a kingdom. We would not tolerate this on the part of some southern sheriff. We wouldn't tolerate it on the part of some northern sheriff. We wouldn't tolerate it on the part of some local DA. We wouldn't tolerate it on the part of a state attorney general. We wouldn't tolerate it on the part of a governor. We didn't tolerate it on the part of King George III. And we're supposed to tolerate it because George W. Bush says he's protecting us. Lawyers said in interviews, from the New York Times again, that they wanted to learn whether the agency monitored those individuals, and if so, whether the government withheld critical information or misled judges and defense lawyers about how and why the Muslims were targeted for investigation. The expected legal challenges in cases from Ohio and Virginia to Florida and Oregon add another dimension to the growing controversy over the agency's domestic surveillance program. They could jeopardize some of the Bush administration's most important courtroom victories in terror cases, legal analysts say. Yeah, he's been protecting us real well. The actual bad guys might get away. It's amazing. It's just absolutely amazing. So anyhow, so now you know the story behind the story. And you know, I'm not going to belabor it any farther. I you know, there's a limit. You got the point. And so when you read the story in the paper tonight or hear it on the evening news, you'll know what it's all about. And you too can help win the water cooler wars and inform your friends and neighbors about what's really going on here in the United States of America. Jay in Los Angeles, California. Hey Jay, thanks for calling. Our 1-866-440-8466. Welcome.
Hey Tom, how you doing?
Good. We got about a minute, Jay.
What's up? Well, I just wanted to talk real quick about data encryption and stuff like the services that people like Skype and Vonage provide to people doing this voice over IP.
Mm-hmm.
And talking about the way that the government is doing a lot of their data mining is just like, you know, looking for needle in a haystack and just piling on more hay.
Right.
And, you know, they're, when we have technologies such as Skype and such, where, you know, I would imagine if I was to be a terrorist or somebody that was actually trying to encrypt my data, that it's pretty easy to do that.
Yeah.
And
they don't even a lot of them, you know, if the reports coming out of the CIA are to be believed, a lot of them aren't even bothering to encrypt the data. They just go into a Japanese gaming room populated by 10-year-olds and communicate there.
Right, right.
I mean, they
right.
go to obscure places.
And
there's
then,
not it's not like there's any shortage
for some reason.
Yeah.
Which I don't understand.
Yeah.
But my point was that this kind of technology that always comes out like this and like peer-to-peer networks and MP3 sharing, you know, the general public, the 15-year-old kids of the world just keep on going like 3-4 steps ahead of the government.
Right.
And every
but,
time
But you know the government has to catch up, but my point is that we have to do it. You have to be able to go before a judge and say, you know, here's the issue.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Let's roll. 1, 2, 3, 4. Imagine there's no heaven. Heaven, 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 heaven. It's easy. If you try, 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 try. No hell. Below us, 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 us. And above us, only sky, 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 sky.
Welcome back, my friends.
Imagine all the people. Living, living for today. Imagine there's no countries, countries, countries. It is not hard to do. Hard to do. Hard to do.
I don't know. The juxtaposition of George W. Bush and John Lennon is just almost too much for my brain. Welcome back. 9 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. The place where reason and passion go together like George W. Bush and warrantless wire searches? I don't know. Anyhow, welcome back to our program. Charlie in Freeport, Pennsylvania. Hey, Charlie, what's on your mind today?
Oh, thank God we got you, Tom. you couldn't fit about 98% of my thinking is about what you're on. But
well, good on you, Charlie.
Okay, back up. I hope to God we don't lose you. Every time we get somebody here, they don't last long. I don't know what the right wing takes them off.
Well,
I've
been here for a while, and I'll continue to be here, so I hope.
I wanted to back up a while there when you I am for the UN. I was for the UN. I was taught in high school. I'm maybe your age or a little older.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think Hitler would have come to power without the UN. But you got to remember, the UN...
You mean you don't think Hitler would have come to power if there had been a UN?
Exactly.
Yeah, because the League of Nations, Woodrow Wilson tried so hard to make that thing
exactly.
happen.
Exactly.
But in the end, he was sabotaged by the Republicans.
I mean, that's the reason I'm for. I think it would have promoted world peace before Hitler would have never got as strong as he did.
Yeah.
But you got to remember, the UN sponsored the WTO.
Now, I didn't know that.
Through the IMF Bank. They're the ones that lean power on the trilateral
I think you're mixing up your agent. Charlie, I may be wrong on this, but I believe
fact,
that the International Monetary Fund is a separate...
I don't have all of it right here, but I remember from the fact that they even promoted NAFTA and GATT originally. In the name of peace now.
I understand what you're saying, but I'm not... I'd ask you... And I can't say that you're wrong. I don't know. But my recollection was that the IMF, the International Monetary Fund, is not part of the UN. That it's a separate agency. But I may well be wrong. It might be a UN.
I don't know
that they promoted the WTO.
Okay, it come back to when we had that tainted baby food stuff.
Yeah. Okay. But to the bottom line here, Charlie, if the UN promoted the WTO, they screwed up big time, and I'm horrified.
Yeah, and that's what screws. That's what really turned me off on the UN.
Yeah, well, the bottom line for me is that Bill Clinton promoted the WTO,
exactly.
And George Bush Sr. promoted the WTO,
exactly.
And the only guy who had the brains or the you know cojones to stand up and say, "Hey, wait a minute, you know this is not going to work," was Ross Perot, and who was you know they characterized in the media as a crazy old coot, and in many ways he really was, but when it came to to business and world and trade policy. Ross Perot knew what he was talking about, and he was talking about that giant sucking sound to the south, and it was, you know, really all over the planet. He mentioned China. He didn't really get it.
Exactly, and the thing that is, I don't have.
Okay, here we are. Alex Goldmark, our chief cook and bottle washer in New York, just IM me. He says the IMF and the World Bank are part of the Bretton Woods agreements. I remember that. I wrote a chapter about this in my book Unequal Protection. Previously, the Bank for Reconstruction and Redevelopment in Europe to administer the money for the Marshall Plan. So they're not part of the UN. So there you go, Charlie. You can rest well, and hopefully. That answers your question. Rick in Los Angeles. Hey, Rick, what's up? And Charlie, thanks for calling in. Rick, what's on your mind?
Thanks for being there. My question is, why aren't we going straight to the industries who guide our politicians and not just deal with the complaint desk, which is what they've become?
Well, when was the last time that you tried to talk to even a mid-level executive in a major corporation? I mean, I had my health insurance company is playing all these games. You know, this is just a regular doctor's office. Did you really do this? Sending, like a half a dozen different pieces of paper, and you have to react to all of them. They're all hoping that you won't react to one so they won't have to pay the bill, right? So I call them up, and I'm all upset and say, I'd like to talk to somebody other than just the poor woman who answers the phone. No, sorry, you can't talk to the executives of this company. So we've lost Charlie here, but that's my issue. You can't get to these people. You can't hope to sit next to them in first class on an airplane because they're on private jets. You can't hope to bump into them in the bus terminal because they take a limousine.
That's
and
right.
You just can't get to them. David in Blaine, Washington. Hey, David, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Great to hear your voice, always.
Thank you.
Yeah, so now we're starting to find out that Condoleezza Rice ordered the eavesdropping of the UN Security Council members prior to the run-up of the war.
All right. Right.
Isn't that interesting? She needs to be, I can't believe these people aren't thrown out of office.
Yeah, and I think you were starting to say thrown into jail.
Why don't the people of Maryland do the whole country a favor and peacefully walk over to Congress, all the buildings, and just hang out?
Well, this is actually the reason why the founders created a separate district that would be the district of the goddess, the goddess Columbia, that they created to be the goddess of America. There's a 19.5-foot bronze statue of her on top of the Capitol building, and that the district and that it would be such a sacred place that the residents wouldn't even have the right to vote, that they wouldn't have a vote in Congress or in the Senate, in the House or in the Senate, and was to provide some insulation between the politicians and any one rogue state. But what do you do when you have rogue politicians? Well, theoretically, that's what you have the courts for, and that's why these guys are trying, they're peddling as fast as they can to try and pack folks like Scalito onto the court.
Thank you, Tom.
Yeah, thank you, David. Good to hear from you. And we've got to wrap up the show here, but so much. Oh, my goodness. Is the National Rifle Association condoning murder? What's new with Spygate tomorrow? We're going to have brunch with Bernie. Be sure to tune in here tomorrow. And don't forget, activism, my friends, begins with you. Tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.